Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and there's a victory today for the Bush administration on the use of medical marijuana following a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. The High Court ruled 6-3 that federal authorities may prosecute sick patients who under state law are allowed to smoke pot on doctor's orders. Well, joining us to explain is Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston. And Lyle, 10 states have voter-approved medical marijuana laws. What does this ruling from the Supreme Court today mean for those laws?
Well, it means that the federal government can, in each one of these states, go after individuals who obtain marijuana on prescription from their doctors and use it for medical purposes. The government now has undisputed authority to carry on criminal prosecutions and investigations. However, under an earlier ruling, the court cannot take away the license of a doctor who prescribes this. That was an earlier decision by the Supreme Court. But now they can go directly after the users, go after people who grow marijuana for personal medical use or people who use it after getting a doctor's prescription.
Well, under the Constitution, the federal government can only trump state law if there's a violation of interstate commerce laws. In this case that was before the Supreme Court, a case from California, the medical marijuana in question was grown in the state. It was for in-state purposes only. It was given to the patients free. So how do justices writing for the majority explain their decision?
Well, they rely upon a 1942 decision by this court, which upheld sweeping authority by Congress to regulate local economic activity or local industry if, in fact, that has an effect on interstate commerce. And so the court relied very heavily on that precedent, saying that if marijuana is grown in California, it could affect the interstate market for marijuana, the illicit market for marijuana across the country, and therefore Congress had the authority to reach down and criminalize it at this very local level.
So even though the supporters of the use of medical marijuana in California are saying it is not sent between states, the Supreme Court suspected it might be?
Yes, the Supreme Court bought the Justice Department's argument that if you allow people to grow it for personal medical use, that will have a direct impact upon the supply of marijuana across the country, and there's no way to make sure that it doesn't filter into the hands of people who would make criminal or illicit use of it in violation of federal law. So it's a sweeping reaffirmation of federal power to control illegal narcotics, particularly marijuana, which does have, despite the government's arguments, some apparent medical value.
Now, the dissenters in the 6-3 ruling were some of the conservative justices, O'Connor, Thomas, and Chief Justice Rehnquist.
They have been a part of a usual 5-justice majority that in recent years has held in a number of cases that Congress does not have the power to reach down into local commerce and regulate. For example, this is a group of 5, including these 3, that struck down a law that banned the possession of guns within 1,000 feet of a school building. But this time they lost because 2 of their number, Justice Kennedy, joined the majority without qualification, and Justice Scalia partially joined it, though he had some reservations about the sweep of the reasoning.
But the odd result is that the more conservative justices essentially took a stand in favor of the use of marijuana within states.
They very clearly did, yes, saying that if states wanted to experiment with this and wanted to look after their own patients, their own citizens' health by doing this, they should be free to do so, but obviously they didn't have the votes today.
Reporter Lyle Denniston speaking to us from the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. Well, the Supreme Court issued several other rulings today. The justices ruled 5-4 in favor of 3 disabled passengers who had sued the Norwegian cruise line claiming inaccessibility on parts of the ship they were on. The ruling means that foreign cruise lines sailing in U.S. waters will have to make their ships more accessible to people in wheelchairs. The decision is an expansion of the Americans with Disabilities Act, but it's not clear how much the cruise industry will have to modify its ships because the ruling specifies that only, quote, readily achievable changes to ships be made. And the High Court rejected a bid by the National Wrestling Coaches Association to sue the federal government over Title IX, the law mandating gender equality in sports programs. The coaches had claimed reverse discrimination, but the justices rejected their case without comment. We all know one of the catalysts for the American Revolution was Britain's tax on tea. But did you know that after the Normandy landings of World War II, the password used by Allied troops was Coca-Cola? And isn't it interesting that Christianity considers wine the blood of Christ, while Islam views wine as an abomination devised by Satan? And both faiths came out of the Middle East. These facts and many more are found in the new book, A History of the World in Six Glasses. It's written by Tom Standage, technology editor for The Economist, and he joins us now in the studio. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
And Tom, I want to get right to the epilogue of your book. Let's start at the ending.
Yep.
You end the book with these lines. When you next raise some beer, wine, spirits, coffee, tea, or Coca-Cola to your lips, think about how it reached you across space and time, and remember it contains more than mere alcohol or caffeine. There is history, too, amid its swirling depths. Were you looking into one of those glasses when you came up with that thought?
Well, that was sort of the inspiration for the book. I mean, what I'm trying to do is tell the story of the world, of human history, through these actually rather mundane, everyday things that, you know, we're very likely to find in your cupboard and in your kitchen. And what's really striking is once you know the story behind those drinks is just what an amazingly tortuous and circuitous route many of them have taken. So there really is history in that cup of tea or that cup of coffee.
Well, just to tantalize us, let's just hopscotch through. Beer.
Okay, so I divide history up instead of the Stone Age and the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. I say, forget all that. Let's have the Beer Age and the Wine Age. So I start with beer in the Stone Age. And beer is possible when people start farming because then they've got a supply of barley. And you consume barley in two ways, as bread and beer. And so the first great civilizations which arise because in Egypt and Mesopotamia, people have taken up farming. You can then have things like cities. You can also have beer. Everyone is drinking beer, even the children. So everyone in Egypt, from the pharaoh down to the smallest child, is drinking beer.
So it perhaps led to the building of cities, but how else? Give me one other
example. Oh, okay. So one of the things you can do with it is since the whole society is running on this grain surplus, grain becomes the currency. So you actually pay people in bread and beer. So the people who built the pyramids, for example, they weren't slaves. They were actually employed by the state, and they were paid 4 loaves of bread and 8 pints of beer a day to build the pyramids.
Wine.
Okay, so wine becomes significant in Greece and Rome. What's particularly interesting is what the philosophers thought of it. Wine was regarded by people like Plato as this a very interesting drink. It was the test of your character. So so one of the Greek poets said that bronze is the mirror of the outward form, and wine is the mirror of the mind. And for the Greeks, wine drinking was all about moderation. It was all about the space in the middle, and you had to mix water with your wine, and that was the correct way of drinking it. And you had to be just drunk enough that you had sort of freedom of tongue and the witticisms were tripping off your tongue, but you weren't actually on the floor in a pile. And Socrates is held up as the ideal man in many respects, and including that he's the ideal drinker. And if you read Plato's Symposium, which is one of many Greek works where the protagonists are sitting around drinking wine and discussing philosophy and other things, at the end of it, everyone else has sort of got a hangover and they've been drinking all night, and Socrates gets up and walks away apparently unaffected. And this tells you a great insight into his character if you're a Greek.
We're going to move on to the other glasses, but by the way, how many books did you read to write this book?
An awful lot of them, yes. I had to drink a lot of glasses of things as well. It was very arduous, as you can imagine.
Moving to spirits.
Okay, so the problem with beer and wine is if you take them on a long sea voyage, they go off. So once age of exploration begins and European explorers start to go round the bottom of Africa and across the Atlantic, they need something else. They need a stronger drink that won't perish and allows you to cram more alcohol into a smaller space. And so you get brandy initially and fortified wines like sherry. And then most importantly of all, you get rum. And I argue in the book that in fact, rum is the drink that we should be associating with American independence as much as tea. And it's because the initial skirmishes between the colonists and the British government were not over tea. They were over the taxation of molasses. And it was the making of molasses into rum that accounted for 80% of the New England economy at the beginning of the 18th century. So when the British government decided it was going to tax molasses, this led to an outcry. And it also led to the first idea that that there should be no taxation without representation. So later on, it all came down to tea. But in fact, the decades leading up to the Tea Act of 1773, the argument was actually about rum.
But hey, that's a large part of our economy still today here in Boston because of the Boston Tea Party. So we don't want to mess.
There's nothing wrong with that.
With that mythology. Moving on to coffee, which is my favorite, I just want to note one of the things that I loved. In 1675, King Charles II of England issued a proclamation for the suppression of coffee houses because of his fears of freedom of speech.
Yes.
Coffee.
Well, this is the thing. Coffee houses were in a tavern. Everyone's, you know, shouting and falling on the floor in a drunken heap. Whereas in a coffee house, rather than making you sort of more likely to punch somebody or fall asleep, coffee sharpens your mind and promotes sort of intellectual discussion. And in fact, coffee houses, which arose in the Arab world, were also frowned upon by the rulers there because they were worried that this led to, naturally, to people discussing philosophy and politics. And they were regarded as rather dubious places. And exactly the same thing happened in London, and things like the Scientific Revolution and the Financial Revolution came out of coffee houses. So Isaac Newton wrote his theory of gravitation in the Principia Mathematica and so on in order to settle a coffee house argument between two other scientists who had been arguing over how gravity worked. Similarly, Lloyd's of London came out of a coffee house. The London Stock Exchange was originally a coffee house. And there are many other examples as well. So coffee houses are places where people get together and exchange ideas, and they sort of the natural result is very often innovation and speculation and revolution. The French Revolution started in a coffee house as well.
In Paris, Café de Foy.
That's right.
And also a Boston coffee house was the site of the first reading of the Declaration of
Independence. So coffee houses are, you know...
Dangerous places.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, look at our Starbucks in a whole different way. You mentioned tea in passing, you know, with the Boston Tea Party, but tea has changed the course of history in other parts of the
absolutely.
World.
Absolutely. Well, the thing about tea was that the East India Company, the British East India Company, had a monopoly on bringing it into England. And they promoted the consumption of tea to the extent that there was enough being brought into England by the end of the 18th century for everyone, even the beggars, to have two cups a day. I mean, there was an enormous amount of tea coming in. And this was great for the East India Company, which was shipping it all. But in fact, it meant that they had an enormous amount of clout over the British government. I mean, their revenues were greater than the British government's, and the tax on tea accounted for 10% of government revenue. So the East India Company was able to boss the government around. And one of the consequences was the Opium War in the 1830s, and this was because by that stage the East India Company was paying for the tea in China using opium instead of silver, which was extremely dodgy. It was sort of government-sponsored drug running. When the Chinese objected to this and burnt an entire year's supply of opium, the East India Company managed to get the British to go to war over it, and that was why Hong Kong was annexed and so forth. So, yes, tea has the particularly strong sort of geopolitical impact, but actually many of these drinks do, and that's what I'm always trying to do, connect the drink to the broader historical context.
That's Tom Standage. He's author of the fascinating new book, A History of the World in Six Glasses. Next up with Tom, Coca-Cola. And what about water? And then later, comic Jonathan Katz on living with and laughing at MS. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking with Tom Standage, technology editor at The Economist and author of the new book, A History of the World in Six Glasses. And Tom, ranking in at number six, Coca-Cola, which has a fascinating but short history when compared to other drinks such as beer and wine. Coca-Cola weaves its way through two world wars. General Dwight Eisenhower was a huge proponent of it during World War II. And in recent years, it was very controversial in the Middle East.
Well, this is the thing, that Coca-Cola was spread around the world on the coattails of the American army during World War II. So at the end of World War II, you could get Coca-Cola in every continent except Antarctica. And it became inevitably associated with American values. And so if you approve of America, that's good. And if you don't, then it's not. And in particular, the Israelis started to say, well, why aren't you selling Coca-Cola here? And the reason that was that the Coca-Cola company was selling its drink in Arab countries where there was a natural market for it because you can't drink alcohol.
Right.
And so, but the trouble was that this was perceived to be a slight against Israel. So they opened an Israeli plant, and then the Arab nations said, "Oh, this is support for Israel, and this is what you expect from an American company," and so on. So then they boycotted Coca-Cola, and so you always get these when Saddam Hussein's palace fell in 2003, and the American troops had a barbecue on the roof. Surprise, surprise, they had hamburgers and Coca-Cola. So it's always associated with American values, and you know, some people think that's good and some people don't.
It's just amazing how much you have managed to find and cram into this book. But you write in your epilogue, if six beverages define the history of mankind, one is emerging as the future beverage, and it's a real simple one: water.
Yeah. Well, this is both good and a bad thing. I mean, the reason that all of these drinks throughout history have been popular is that they provided a safer alternative to water. So for most of human history, it wasn't understood why water got contaminated. And this is just a natural consequence of human waste going into water. And as soon as you have even a small village, this happens straight away. So beer and wine and spirits are all safer to drink than water. And the same is true. Coffee is then the first non-alcoholic alternative, which is why, you know, everyone wakes up when coffee shows up, because previously they've been drinking alcohol all day. And then tea, similarly, has great antibacterial properties, it turns out. So ultimately, today, we now understand how you make water clean, and we can pipe it into our homes and it's clean. But the weird thing is, no one wants to drink it. They want to drink bottled water, which is basically the same stuff.
I mean, tell me about that, because you find in your detail that most bottled water is just tap water.
Yeah, about 40%. I mean, Dasani and Aquafina, which are the leading bottled water brands in this country, are not mineral waters. They are municipal waters.
With a filter.
Yeah, which have been filtered, and in some cases, they've had minerals added to them. The water is sort of encapsulating this division between the haves and have-nots today. And water is also politically important. Boutros Ghali, the former head of the UN, has said that, you know, the next war in the Middle East will be over water, not over oil or politics. If you look really far forward, if we want to go and live on the moon or on Mars, or if we're looking for life elsewhere in the solar system, you actually have to find water first. So water is absolutely crucial to humankind's future development.
And yet, as you point out, it's the first time in human history that you can drink it pretty much safely.
Yes, exactly.
In the West, in most countries.
An enormous breakthrough, because my book starts in about sort of 10,000 BC, and then it's only in the last 150 years that we've figured out how to produce safe water, and it's a great achievement. And it wouldn't cost very much to extend it to everyone else in the world. It would cost about $2 billion above the current spending on these things to provide safe drinking water to everybody. You really need to have sanitation as well. That's about another $9 billion a year. The annual spending on bottled water now is $46 billion a year, and most of it's unnecessary because it's in the rich world where the tap water is perfectly safe.
Tom Standage, again, the book, A History of the World in Six Glasses. We're just spending a few seconds on the seventh, the future, water. What was the most surprising thing to you in doing this book?
A couple of things. The first was that I started the book as a wine buff. And originally, I was going to try and do history just through wine. But I discovered that you really have to have these other drinks in there, too. I mean, you can't talk about ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia and not do beer. And anyway, the main thing I learned while doing this, the thing that surprised me, was that I became very interested in beer and in the different kinds of beer and in the processes used to make it. And I now actually drink more beer than I do wine. So that was one thing. I also discovered that I rather like rum, I mean, particular kinds of rum. I never used to drink any spirits at all, and I still drink hardly any spirits, but whiskey doesn't really float my boat, but rum is jolly nice.
When you do have a little rum or a cup of coffee or a tea, are you thinking about the history of that drink?
I can't not. I mean, I got to the point when I was writing the book where everything I was doing, you know, I'd go to a museum and I'd see a painting or an artifact, and I would think, what was the person who made that painting or who made that artifact? What were they drinking when they went home? And that was always, you know, what were they drinking? That was my sort of touchstone to try and figure it out. I really do. I mean, drinking is a very mundane thing. You know, it's a very basic thing that everyone has to do it. But that's what gives it such a such power to illuminate history, because absolutely everybody has to do it. Otherwise, you die. Mm. It's as simple as that. And so it gives you a very nice way to do a cross section through a society and to look at, you know, who is drinking what and why and where it came from.
Wow, as I savor this cup of whatever, it launched a revolution, or It saved a civilization, or...
Well, yes, I mean, for example, grog, you know, rum mixed with water and lime juice and sugar. And this is what the sailors in the Royal Navy used to drink, and that was why they were called limeys, because of the lime juice in there. And the useful thing about the lime juice is it fends off scurvy, and that means that the Navy was much more effective. And the French Navy didn't have grog, and they weren't drinking lime juice, and they all had scurvy, and that was why we won at Trafalgar. I mean, and this was recognised at the time. So you can argue that, you know, grog was the drink that defeated Napoleon, ultimately. I mean, I don't go quite as far as some of these claims. I mean, there are anthropologists out there who say, you know, that the purpose of farming in the first place was to ensure the beer supply. So beer is literally, you know, the reason that there's any civilization at all today. And I don't go quite as far as that, but I do think that that drinks have had a much greater influence on the course of history than most people realize.
Tom Standage, technology editor for The Economist. His new book is called A History of the World in Six Glasses. You must be just a ball at cocktail parties.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, wine boards, you know, once you get them started. And I can't look at any of these drinks without, without thinking about all these other strange things I've learnt about them along the way.
Tom, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, whistleblowers react to W. Mark Felt. Why didn't they go to reporters the way Deep Throat did? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Five suburban teams in the Pop Warner Youth League, a league for 7 to 13-year-olds, say they want to drop out of a league dominated by inner-city Boston teams. The Boston Globe reported today that the suburban teams want to leave because they want to play kids in their own area. But issues of safety were also cited, with some team officials saying they were concerned after one child was shot during a Pop Warner practice. Suburban team officials also say intimidating rap music is played at city games, and racial epithets have been thrown at their suburban players. Well, joining us on the line first is Jonathan Gates of the Mattapan Patriots, one of the inner city teams. And Jonathan, one of your colleagues from the Dorchester Eagles says that this proposed move is racist. What do you say?
You're talking about kids from the 7 to 13. Kids are not born to be racist, to say certain things, or to act a certain way. We as the adult have to take responsibility and say, no, this is what we need our kids to be. Until we get out of that mindset and stop teaching these kids black against white and white against black, we're going to perpetuate and keep going through the same cycle.
A letter from the Needham Wellesley Pop Warner group to the board of directors of your organization, and again, this is a suburban school, cited several inappropriate comments. Coaches, for instance, calling a black player a traitor because he was playing for the largely white suburban school.
Well, I charged that person who wrote it, because I said it to him at the board meeting when he brought it up. Were you on the field when it was said? And I said, you sure it wasn't a child? Because children say anything against anybody. But on the same instance, the instance they're talking about, where our kids go to the Needham Wellesley to pay them, the kids say the N-word, and, you know, and they spit at them. They step on their hands. They kick them. And the parents and everything's applauding. But we don't get negative about it. We're playing football. We're not playing chess here, and they're talking about it's too physical, it's too rough. As a society, we as the adult have to take the upper hand and say, hey, this is not right.
Well, Jonathan, if those things were happening to your kids when they traveled to the other schools...
It does happen.
Well, why would you keep them in Pop Warner then?
Well, when it does happen, just like in society, I don't know, like, where you're working here, if I came to get your job and the ownership said, nah, we don't want you, although you're more qualified than the host that's already there, we're going to keep her because of status quo. I'm not supposed to put my head in the sand and say, well, I can't do anything else because they won't let me. No, you move forward and you teach them right from wrong and you keep moving. The game of football is like a game of life. You can't bury your head and run away from everything.
So you're saying that the schools should confront these issues rather than walk away from them?
That's the bottom line. We can have an open forum. We have the right to disagree on anything. But as adults, we should be able to do this behind closed doors instead of in the media, instead of in this forum. from, so that way we can sit down and say, okay, this is what you don't like. Well, here's the issues and the things that we need to change as an adult so the children don't have to go through this.
I misspoke. I said schools, but these are not schools. They're teams, as you said, Pop Warner teams.
Yes, ma'am.
What will happen to Pop Warner if these schools pull out?
If these organizations pull out, Pop Warner will still survive. You understand? But, you know, if you want to leave, you have that right to leave. But don't say because you feel unsafe, because, I see one of them stated in there was a shooting at practices every day. Well, nobody brings up, there's more rape, there's more drug use, there's more child molestation in the suburban area. But, we don't bring it up. We just want to play football so our kids can grow together. But the spin being put on it, they're trying to say they're leaving because of the safety of their children coming into the urban sector, which I think is just an underlying line of saying we're tired of getting beat.
Jonathan Gates is with the Mattapan Patriots and urban neighborhood Pop Warner team in Boston. Jonathan, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem.
Al Perillo is regional director of Pop Warner. He joins us now on the phone. Al, what do you think of what Jonathan was saying, that the suburban teams are pulling out just because they can't compete, that the urban teams are better?
Well, I've been given two reasons for the reason why the suburban teams in the Bay State League want to leave. One of them is, and the most important, is they want to form a Bay State League that coincides with the Bay State High School League that their high school teams play in. They feel this will make them develop more rivalries and so forth, which will be the same rivalries the boys and girls will experience when they get to high school. Regarding the scores and the competitiveness of it, Pop Warner has two divisions, Division One, Division Two. Of all the teams in the Boston area, there are two that are obviously Division One teams. One of those is the Dorchester Eagles. The other is the Boston Raiders.
Well, the Dorchester Eagles have won the conference championship and made it to the national championship at Disney World for the past 4 years.
Right. They're Division One. That's what I'm saying. They're a very top-flight program, and the teams from the suburbs that go in to play them and the Boston Raider team normally have been getting beat. But it's not a matter of safety. It's not a matter of race, in my opinion. I talked to Harry Wilson, who has run the Boston Raider program for 30 years, he tells me he's been involved. For the first 20 years Harry was involved, all they did was play Boston teams. Somewhere around 8 to 10 years ago, Harry brought them into Pop Warner, and the reason he did so was so the boys and girls could begin playing teams from the suburbs, could get a little different culture, meet children from other areas, see what some of the suburbs and the cities look like. And this is something that Pop Warner endorses completely.
But we understand that since that time, predominantly white suburban teams have been leaving, that this is part of a trend.
Well, Jonathan hit the nail on the head. If they had a problem, and some of the things that he's referring to, frankly, I haven't heard of having happened. But if there are problems of that nature, they need to document it, write it up, and report it to the league president, and we would thoroughly investigate it and try to fix what's wrong. Jonathan alluded to those kind of things and those kind of remedies that are available to the Pop Warner teams.
How damaging do you think it would be if these schools and cultures just separated completely?
Well, we're working on something along those lines now, because that seems to be one of the only ways out of this that that makes sense at this point. We are going to have a meeting this Thursday night where we're going to make some options available to the Bay State League and separate options available to the Boston teams. But again, it won't be just Boston teams playing Boston teams. We have some other areas and teams for them to play in and around the greater Boston area that they haven't played before, but they're not the suburban teams from out in the Bay State area either. So we're going to try to address that, try to come to a situation that both sides will be happy with and go on from there.
But in a way, isn't that kind of sad, as you said, because the original goal was to help different cultures see each other?
Yeah, I went to Mass yesterday at 11 o'clock Mass, and I heard a service that was given in English, Italian, Portuguese, and Spanish. Four languages. They had four lecturers up there saying everything. This is what today's day and age is all about. We need to accept this and deal with it, not scream, throw your hands up in the air and say, I quit.
Al Perillo, regional director of Pop Warner. Al, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Still to come, when we spoke with comic Jonathan Katz a year ago, he'd just been diagnosed with MS and was wondering if he could find the humor in that. Well, he has, and he's coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. The Roman Catholic Diocese in Spokane, Washington, has filed documents in bankruptcy court saying that it does not own 81 churches and other buildings, and so cannot sell those assets to pay alleged victims of sexual abuse by priests. The diocese claims the buildings are owned by the parishioners and only held in trust by the bishop of the diocese. Plaintiffs in the case have asked the judge to rule that the parishes and other Catholic entities are owned by the bishop and therefore available to settle those claims. Meanwhile, in Boston, dozens of churches and other buildings have been put on the market to raise funds for the archdiocese hobbled by its own sexual abuse crisis. And now the National Trust for Historic Preservation has placed all of the Catholic churches in Boston up for sale on their list of America's 11 most endangered places. Well, joining us in the studio to talk about all of this is WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyeroff. And Monica, first of all, who owns these churches?
That's a good question, and it's one that's being fought out in courts across the country. As you said, the Diocese of Spokane filed for bankruptcy, and in their filing, they said the assets are owned by the parishioners. Now, that's being paid a lot of attention to because here in Boston, at least one parish has also filed in court a civil suit over this issue, and in their lawsuit, they say the parishioners paid for and owned the church building and all the assets, and the archdiocese holds it in trust. This lawsuit is pending, but they're keeping a close eye in Spokane, because if that court rules that the parishioners own the assets, then a lot of parishioners in the Boston area are going to say, wait a second, you can't sell your church. This is our church and it's our asset.
Right. They said so in Spokane. Well, and then to Boston, why put all of the churches of Boston on this endangered list? Do they all rise to historic significance?
Well, some preservationists argue no, they don't all rise to preservation status. But this is an annual list that's been going on since 1988, and it's really used to capture attention to historic buildings. It's not regulatory. No money comes with it. These buildings don't automatically get saved. The nonprofit advocacy group that spotlights this, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, says that they were encouraged really to title this simply the Historic Catholic Churches of Boston, even though Wendy Nicholas, the Northeast Regional Director of the National Trust, said that of the 83 churches and other buildings that the Archdiocese is closing, they estimate that only about half are really considered historic and architecturally significant.
We're using the listing as a way to energize elected officials and community leaders, neighborhood leaders, and the development professionals to think creatively and proactively about ways to save these churches and retain them as part of our communities in the Commonwealth.
So, Monica, as you've been reporting, this sounds like there's a good mix of politics going on here.
Yeah, I think so. You know, some of the preservationists I spoke to said that a lot of these churches don't need saving. They will be preserved. There's already a huge movement underway to do that. I spoke with Susan Parker Browner. She owns a real estate development company on Cape Cod that specializes in adapting historic properties for mixed use. And she says, really, she doesn't think a lot of the churches would be demolished if once they're sold.
I think that the churches are reasonably well protected as opposed to a number of other buildings that could have been selected. If it's politically appropriate, if you look at the threatened list, it is literally all over the country. And if they really needed to do something in the Boston area, there are some things that are in far more danger than a lot of the churches in the Archdiocese.
One thing she points to is a church on Cape Cod, the South Harwich Meeting House. It's on the National Historic Register, and it's in danger of just collapsing in on itself. And she also notes that the Archdiocese itself says that they want to keep in mind the historic nature of the structures as they're selling them. So they are looking at whether people plan to bulldoze them and put in a Target or a Walmart or preserve the historic structure when they decide who they're going to sell this property to.
And we're reminded that last year the National Trust listed the entire state of Vermont on its preservation list, so it's not unusual to put groups of buildings or even cultures.
No, it's not. This year also had all of downtown Detroit and an island, King Island in Alaska, that's home to a tribe of Indians that's nearly extinct, and they want to bring them back, help preserve the culture, really, not as much the buildings. The buildings are wood shacks, honestly, but they sometimes go for groups of people or areas to highlight the importance of a culture or building structures.
WBUR's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. Monica, thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Recently, fans filled Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Somerville, Massachusetts, awaiting the return to the stage of comic Jonathan Katz, who'd been diagnosed a year ago with multiple sclerosis.
Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Katz!
When we spoke a year ago, when you went public with your diagnosis, you said at the time you were kind of nervous about this idea of comedy act featuring MS. How do you feel now that you're doing it?
Well, I still feel like I'm sharing the bill with my illness, and I have top billing. As long as it's that way, I'm okay.
Hey, is there anybody in this room who feels like they have not gotten their money's worth yet? Too soon? All right.
On stage, Jonathan walks slowly with a cane or sits at a computer to play snippets from his Emmy Award-winning animated show, Dr. Katz, Professional Therapist. He banters with the audience and with longtime collaborator Tom Snyder at the piano. And about 20 minutes in, there's a slideshow.
I wanted to say that I miss doing this so much. I do. I miss...
Why do you just keep doing it?
Well, you know, I guess this is where some people feel like I'm sort of dodging the issue. Because in 1997, I was diagnosed with MS. In 1996, I look like this.
And then I say, in 1996, I look like this. And all of a sudden, you see an image of this guy, Jonathan Katz, except I have an afro and I have the body of a Greek god.
And now I have to ask, is there anybody, because there are millions of people in the world with MS. Does anybody else in this room have MS? By applause? You have MS? How are you doing?
Okay.
Yeah.
You ask by applause, how many in the audience have MS? And then the woman next to me said she did. Are you taken aback by that, or does someone usually say so?
No, somebody usually does. I'm surprised when nobody does. I think there are something like almost a million Americans with MS.
No two people are affected the same, but it is an illness that where you recognize things in retrospect. Like one of my first symptoms was I was at Martha's Vineyard. I was racing my brother-in-law, very competitive, especially him. And so
we were racing at Martha's Vineyard, and that year, for the first time, he won. And he won because I fell down. But if you look closely at the x-rays, you can see I was ahead of the time I fell. And at that point, the audience is seeing x-rays of the fall.
Let's talk about the mystery surrounding MS. Near the equator, it's virtually unknown. And we figured out that simply by raising the equator as little as 500 miles, we can reduce the incidence of MS by 21%.
I think people appreciate it. People who haven't thought about anything even remotely funny in a while. I mean, people are so delicate on the subject of disability and illness. I think it's sort of comforting to people to hear somebody talking playfully about it.
Multiple sclerosis is a disorder of the central nervous system. It can lead to long-term disability. There is no cure, and a popular drug, Tysabri, was recently pulled from the market. So you'd think not a lot of yucks. But later, at Jonathan's home, Tom recalls the time that in a show of solidarity, he rode a little scooter alongside Jonathan's as they made pitches to Hollywood executives.
The first receptionist we rolled up to, she couldn't see us because we were just under the ridge.
She really see your hands.
Yes.
They thought it was a puppet show.
For some people, it's an illness. For me, it's a hook. It's a really awful, horrific illness. Not for me in particular, but it can be and might become for me. And Tuesday I went to a place called the Boston Home, which is a place, it's a residence for people living with MS who have been there for many, many years, some of them. And that was difficult because I got to see a scarier version of the same illness. But they laughed.
Terry Gara, another MS sufferer. Do you talk to other people?
Yeah, I don't call her a sufferer, though.
What would you call her?
A woman. I mean, I wouldn't call you a public radio sufferer.
Well, you could.
Okay. I mean, she does so much more than suffer in a given day. She has been diagnosed with MS, and she's on the MS circuit.
Is there one?
Yeah, I mean, I was on the circuit for a while. It's people who talk about living with MS and get paid by the pharmaceutical companies that make MS drugs. And I am very competitive with those people. Whereas I said to Terry, I'm going to make you wish you had lupus.
A serious note for just a moment. You mentioned the MS drugs. Controversy over them recently.
Yeah, the drug I was taking got yanked because of a bad side effect. The guy died, which is often fatal.
And here there was this hopeful drug, and now, I mean, your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, it is like having the rug pulled out from under you, because so much of living with an illness like MS is just hope. And that doesn't sound like me, does it, Tom?
Well,
I'm not without hope. I mean, I don't wake up in the morning and say, oh my God, if only. I wake up in the morning and try to write jokes. You know, I wake up, it's comedy that keeps me involved in life, not to mention my wife and daughters. I told you not to mention my wife and daughters. I used to consider myself kind of a graceful man, an athlete. I was New York State table tennis champion, I think you know that.
Can you play at all anymore?
I can, and I still enjoy it. I can't play as well as I used to because I tend to bump into things.
You seem happy.
I'm in a pretty good mood. I'm oddly exhilarated today.
It's not that bad, but it's only because Jonathan insists that it not be that bad. Frankly, it's a miracle to me that he's handling it so many million times better than I would. I think I'm astounded.
I think some of the time I'm in denial, and comedy is a great place to be hanging out if you're in denial. There are so many things you could get pissed off about if you wanted to. I never noticed handicapped parking signs in my life before, and there should be more of them. But also, one of the things I told my wife is that I don't want to become one of these angry guys who's riding around on a scooter mumbling because there's no curb cut, you know? I wouldn't mind riding next to that guy.
The stage show ends with a faux interview between Tom and John, and any lingering doubts that the two will ever wallow in the maudlin in discussing MS are, well, quickly cut off.
Tell me about your week. What's your relationship with MS like this week? It's different every week.
Well, you know, it was kind of a dramatic...
I'm sorry.
Thank you so much.
Comic Jonathan Katz. We also spoke with his longtime collaborator Tom Snyder, the inventor of Swiggle Vision, by the way. Jonathan will be voicing a new character in a new animated show this fall. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.